Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and blessings. Blessings and greetings, blessed souls. God bless you, good men, and we're alive because we want to stay alive. And we just had a technical problem. We got about almost four minutes of live recording, and we even lost our co-host, Dennis Ryan. I hope Dennis will call back. This is the 72nd class of Soul Class. Okay, we're going to call him Dennis now. Dennis,
is that you?
Hi. Yeah, we had a technical difficulty. My cell phone disconnected. Did you hear the music, Eyes of a Child?
I did, and it was very inspirational.
Yes. And Dennis, before we get into our dialogue, and hopefully we'll be joined a little bit later by Levite musician Peretz Levine, maybe Ron Williams, I know, I'm a scholar. Mordechai Sondag, I don't think will join us. He's been stricken with the flu. May Hashem send him healing. Dennis, let's just remind everyone, this is Soul Class. We are dedicated in these few minutes or hour and a half we have, hopefully on a continually weekly basis, to dedicate ourselves to inviting everyone to understand that Soul is an acronym for S7O, original or oldest, U, universal L laws, which is alluding to the seven Noahide commandments, which I'll state very succinctly, and I'll reveal a new insight I actually learned from a friend last night based on the teaching of Rabbi Yossi Patel Patiel in Karnak. And those seven Noahic commandments are: 1, not to blaspheme the Creator with the Creator's name; 2, not to serve idols; 3, not to commit premeditated acts of murder; 4, not to commit acts of idolatry; 5, not to steal; 6, not to eat the limb of an animal while it's still alive; / not to commit unwanted and unnecessary acts of cruelty against animals; 7, to raise up righteous statutes across the line in every part of creation for every nation that will ensure that we live on this earth in a peaceful, pleasant manner, as is alluded to in chapter 45, verse 18, in the prophet Isaiah: the world was created to be a settled place. Dennis, now what I want to share with everyone before we get to the meat of our discussion with today's particular class will be the healing of America via faculty of speech, part 7, is that a good friend of mine, Yeheskel Levy, who lives out in Ohio, was telling me he was listening to a radio program or a tape program last week, that these seven Noahic commandments actually are seven categories of commandments. So people have complained to me, whether on the show or off the show, in person or email, that we Jewish people are trying to limit all inhabitants of the world to just do seven commandments. And that can be the furthest from the truth, because the flip side of not blaspheming the Creator is praising the Creator. It only makes sense, right, Dennis?
Well, that does make sense, but the concept of bringing the Creator to the subject matter so people can discuss it is very important. It's not so much to what people's motives are. We cannot go around questioning that all the time. That will go on forever. So therefore, the constant is God, and we have to concentrate on that. And that's one of the reasons why we have this program, is to have better understanding of God.
Right. And the flip side of not serving idols is to how do you serve a one Creator who is actually beyond the concept of numerical oneness, but really is alluding to an inclusiveness of all of creation. And I just saw something, Dennis, over the weekend. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said that it's incumbent on a Jewish person, and this really is incumbent on any person of consciousness of the nation, to explain to another human being how we are all rooted, what's embedded in our DNA, not just because we have a divine image, but because it's embedded in the fiber of creation, that all of us are included in a divine plan coming from a divine mindset who's coming from the Most High, who's the source of all these logistical issues that we human beings are trying to sort out, not only in our daily lives, but we take a moment to contemplate like we are right now. Would you like to comment, Dennis?
Well, we have to be cognizant of the fact that there is a God, and we have to address it. We cannot avoid it. By avoiding it, it's like you said, are we emphasizing the negative if we're not emphasizing the positive? Because we must spend our time while we're here on the earth to praise the Lord and honor Him. And that way we can live better lives.
Amen. Beautiful, Dennis. Also, I want to mention that a friend of mine, his name is, he's a Facebook friend, his name is Rudy Detner, I believe, STD. Let me just go back here. Let me just make sure I'm spelling his name right. For those of you who are connected to Facebook, if anyone wants to connect to a nice distributor of knowledge of what's going on in the world, the name is Rudy, R-U-D-I, and then the last name is STETTNER, and he tries to look at the world from every angle. He sees the world from 360 points, which really is what a circle is made of, 360 points. And he tries to bring out the good and that which needs improvement on every issue. So what I want to share with everyone today is that something he brought to light this past Friday, March 25th, 2011, and then I'll certainly ask your commentary on this and how, say, individuals like yourself are not trying to fight against this type of violence. I'd like to read this article. It's very short, but it's very powerful. So it reads that thousands of Ethiopian Christians were burned out of homes by Muslim terrorists. And Rudy Stetner reported the following: thousands of Ethiopian Christians have been burned out of their homes and churches in attacks that left approximately 50 churches destroyed and dozens of Christian homes in ruins. The pogrom in the Ethiopian town of Sendabo, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, was sparked by rumors that a Christian had desecrated a copy of the Quran. The attacks had been going on for some time, according to the ECE project, a group that cites three fatalities and many injuries in its report from the strife-torn area. The website, CatholicCulture.org, cites a figure of 69 churches burned, as well as a school and an orphanage. Radio Netherlands, as well as other sources, cites an Ethiopian Muslim terrorist group known as Kawarja, which is K-A-W-A-R-J-A, as being the son of extremist agitation among the Muslim youth of Sendabo. Local Muslim leaders say that they've been trying to counter the influence of the secretive and violent sect. Additionally, local authorities have cracked down on the activities of Kawarja, resting on 130 suspects of assortment of charges related to the violence. All this belated support comes as scant assurance to the Christians of Sendabo, who note that it was their own neighbors who took part in the violence that left them homeless. So Radio Netherlands reports Woldy Georgis, a Christian resident of Sendabo, as follows, quote, I don't care who started the violence. The fact is that thousands of local Muslims, my neighbors, have participated in it. That's why I don't see a future for me and other Christians in this town anymore, unquote. In all probability, the rumors of Quran desecration by Christians were not only false, but probably purposely started by the terrorists themselves to serve as a pretext for anti-Christian violence. The only dishonor to the Quran and Islam in Sendabo was brought upon by the Muslims themselves. Mere apologies will have to be backed up with punishment of those guilty of the outrage in Sendabo, as well as assistance to the Christians in rebuilding their homes, churches, orphanage, and although Rudy didn't write this, I'll say their lives, because once a person's place of worship and orphanage and place of living is destroyed, he's basically starting all over again. Dennis, your take on this article, and I'm sure I'm going to agree with what you're going to say now, but we publicly condemn this type of religious fanaticism, which is basically just a subterfuge for being violent and saying it's in the name of one's faith.
Well, it's a subterfuge for hatred. It's a way of taking, let's say, uneducated people who will believe in bits and pieces because they don't understand the whole picture. But people use this as another form of marginalizing their religion but emphasizing their hate. And what happens is all people, regardless of your religion, if you believe in God, you become a target. You become a target of those people who want to destroy or tear that down, and they will try it in any way, shape, form, or fashion. This has been going on since history's been recorded. If you believe that you are doing something right, the people who don't have the same belief don't like you. They don't like you because they figure you have something they don't have. But instead of trying to find out what it is, they rebel or revolt, or they take out their hatred against it. It's very hard to straighten out human nature when hatred is the basis for everything. And that's why we have this radio program. We're trying to show that love is a better basis than hatred.
Amen. And in the end, love shall conquer hatred. Because always, I think that love is an expression of human emotion, which is expansive. Hatred is constricting and contracting and too limiting to the point where one's senses are dulled by one's hatred. Dennis, before we get back into our discussion, I think we have Paris Levine on the show. Let's call him in. Paris, is that you? Hello. Oh, is that Cottrell?
Boker Tov, Chabad. Cottrell here.
Boker Tov. Shalom Aleichem, Cottrell. Cottrell, we have Dennis Ryan on the phone. And Dennis Ryan, we have Cottrell Gore, who is the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, an organization dedicated to uplifting human lives in the five boroughs of New York economically and, as per need, spiritually as well. Cottrell, how are you doing this morning?
pretty good. And by the way, just last night I found a Supreme Court case that documented what I was talking about, when you can have a constitutional defense for not paying income taxes. And the case is called the United States versus Cheek, 1991, where a man
Can you spell that name, please?
C-H-E-E-K. Cheek.
Okay, cheek, like the side of the face.
Correct. The case
United States
versus Cheek, 1991, where he proved he had a constitutional right to not pay federal income taxes on wages. He has to pay income taxes on farm investments, stock market investment, real estate investments, but on wages, he was able to prove he was not able to, he was not required to pay taxes on wages. I just learned that last night quite by accident because I was looking for something else. My elderly boss, my old boss, used to say, if you want to find something, you'll find it when you're looking for something else. And as I was looking for something else, I came across the case of the United States versus Cheek, which proved the theories and philosophy of one of my guests to my club a few years ago. I don't know if you heard the case, but I found the case just last night.
Well, you know what, Dennis? We're like in a different mode. I think I'll have to do a little research on that, and hopefully a future show we'll talk about that and how does that relate to people's basic rights in terms of what the government can impose upon the people and what the people should take as a responsibility towards government. But Dennis and I just got into a conversation about publicly condemning via this radio show. I don't know if you heard about this. Cartel, but actually thousands of Ethiopian Christians have just been burned out of their homes and churches because of a charge which, according to various sources, were false charges that a Christian person had burned a Quran, which left thousands and thousands of people without their churches, without their homes, and without in a particular place in a town called Asandabo in Ethiopia, without an orphanage. What would you like if you left to join us in this public condemnation of using religious beliefs as a subterfuge for wanton acts of violence of one person against another?
It doesn't sound good, of course. It doesn't sound the least bit justifiable.
Right. Now, I do know, gentlemen, from the law, the Seven Noahide Commandments, aside from the fact that a nation is not supposed to, make war on another nation, that, for instance, let's say you have, I'm just giving a scenario, not to incite a scenario, but so let's say Pakistan goes to war against India. Now, we know that Pakistan has a large Muslim population, and according to Torah teachings, Muslim is a monotheistic religion, which we don't have a problem with, although we don't appreciate the anti-Semitic and anti-Christian attitudes, calling us heathens or applying what is known as the Sharia of Dini, where anyone who is a Christian or a Jew is held to be of second-class citizenship. We certainly don't approve of that. But the Indian people, are involved in, unfortunately, in certain types of worship, which we would consider of the Torah or biblical perspective as idolatrous, because they have shrines that they bow to or pray to, they burn incense to certain shrines. However, according to the Noahide Commandments, the country of Pakistan is not allowed to attack India in order to eradicate their idolatry. In fact, it has gone on in other places. I'm trying to remember in an area that's close to India, because I've met people who have been ransacked, their families have been ransacked by Muslim adversarial individuals. So the thing is that basically, the Noahide Commandments, in a certain sense, has a certain, I'd like the gentleman to chime in, has a certain, so to speak, libertarian isolationist type of viewpoint, which is not supposed to be that we should just only care about themselves, but everyone has to clean up their own backyard. That's the context I want to speak within. And I'd like you gentlemen to speak about how the importance of how each country has to sort of to clean up their own backyard before they start imposing their viewpoints on others. Dennis, would you like to chime in?
Well, the imposing will go on for the time immemorium because everybody thinks the other people should think our way. But that's a human problem, and we got to learn to live with each other. However, there are basic things, and regardless of what religion you practice, peace is in a very important part of that religion. I've known many Hindus, many Islamic people, as well as Christians, non-Christians, Jewish, anybody, you name it, there's always peace at the bottom of their religion because you cannot have disruption, you cannot have hate, you must have something positive. And in the human sense, peace, peace of mind, peace of your body, peace of living is part of what we're here for. If you cannot enjoy your life to a certain extent here, then what are we doing? So therefore, we must be cognizant of the fact that other people also have these peaceful type of objectives. Unfortunately, the media and other things emphasize when something has always gone wrong or somebody does something wrong. Hatred, violence it never stops. It's always in the news. It will keep on going. Hatred is one of those basic things that humans like to rely on when they don't rely on God. So therefore, we have to deal with it and face it.
Right. Karcha, what's your take on this subject matter?
From what I understand, the Muslims are even more theologically hostile to the Hindus than they are to Christians and Jews because they see Hindus as worshiping multiple gods through idols. And they tend to think, however, there are people who say that Christians worship three gods. Now, there's hardly any Christian who will say that they worship three gods. But that is how a lot of non-Christians view Christians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm the grandson of a minister. And Christians, with the exception of the Unitarians, for the most part, believe that the one God has three different aspects that you should be aware of, but that there are three different gods. You may have a mother. You have just one mother, but your mother can be your teacher, your maid, and your best friend. She has three different aspects, you know. She could be your breadwinner, you know. And she's still just one mother. From what I understand also of Islam, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there.
But I personally think that there are a lot of good Muslim faithful people who are very, they abhor and they protest silently because they're afraid to come out publicly because of that, the mentality, unfortunately. And listen, that mentality exists in all the faiths. I've met, unfortunately, Jewish people who have an attitude which I find very distasteful, that they not only want to, you know, stuff what we call Yiddishkeit, or you call Judaism, or, you know, faith to the Torah down other people's throats, where they themselves are not necessarily the quote-unquote the most kosher. I've met Christian people like that, and I've met Indian people who, again, have those idolatrous beliefs. They're some of the nicest people I've met. You know, so I take an example of, say, like Mother Teresa. Now, Mother Teresa and I, theologically speaking, I would not agree with Catholicism as a theology or way of life. However, her act, her self-sacrifice, makes her one of the greatest heroes of the 20th century. The very fact that she dedicated her lives to working in a leper colony, that woman was intensely connected to the Most High, because we learned last week, because you didn't participate, I learned with Dennis and Ron Williams, that there is actually aspect of Jewish law which says that whoever supports the spirit of the poor and the broken is actually manifesting a quality of the divine presence or the Shekhinah through their very actions. So Mother Teresa manifested in her own unique way the divine presence by helping the lepers, or not lepers colony. So to me, the theology issue, the differences go to the side, because the woman was actually trying to fulfill what's written again, as I mentioned earlier in the program, chapter 45, verse 18, to make the world a settled place. Dennis, would you like to comment?
Well, all religions basically approve and suggest that we should all be doing good deeds. But a lot of us just don't have it within us to do it. It's like a fear that something may rub off or something may go wrong. But we must help out other people. And part of all our basic religions, regardless of which it is, you must love your neighbor, because your neighbor was created in the same image you were. And if you honor the creator, then you must honor the neighbor. I mean, it's a very simple formula. However, it isn't just doing it in your mind. You must practice it. You must help out people who cannot really help themselves. But you must be willing to do it. If you're willing to do it, that means you accept the love of God because you're practicing what he preached.
Beautiful. Katsa, you're still a truant officer in New York City? Katsa? Maybe Katsa stepped away from the phone for a second. Anyway, Dennis, I didn't ask you before the show, unfortunately, but maybe do you have the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed in proximity to yourself?
I don't leave home without it, Don.
Okay, I read up the Rambam because, Dennis, last night I saw a video in my congregation. This Tuesday night, actually, in Crown Heights, I'd like to personally extend an invitation. Maybe, Dennis, you can get over it. If you can, I'll try to meet you over there. There's going to be a celebration of the conclusion of learning the epic work of Rambam. Rambam just didn't write Guides to the Perplexed. He wrote something called Mishneh Torah, which has 14 volumes, which encapsulates all the laws of the Jewish faith. And the Rebbe Rebbe said that, very interesting enough, that there's an interesting phenomenon in the realm within Torah physics, which is the interaction of energy and matter, that actually those sages of Israel, and I would imagine too this applies to all the people who preceded Israel, which are the Noahites or the Adamites, or the direct descendants of Adam, and wherever we see scriptural phrases or the Talmudic phrases or Midrash phrases, oral Torah transmissions, that when we speak their words of Torah, we actually cause their lips to move in the grave. And when their lips are moving in the grave, it actually projects a certain energy into the world. So that's why I wanted you to pull out God's books, Dennis, now, because it, like I said, it actually affects the air, the atmosphere, the sense of awareness of what's going on in the world. So then before you reach into the God that perplexed, I'd like to share something about the nature of soul powers of human beings. But this is from Rambam's teaching in the 8 chapters of Rambam, which were preparatory teachings concerning the Perkei Avot, the teachings of our sages, the ancient sages of Israel. The Rambam mentions this, that we should know, observing Torah's instructions or rebelling against them actually involves only two elements of the faculties of the soul. Number one is, there's an element of our soul that's involved in governing how we sense things, and then there's an element in our soul that governs how we are stimulated by matters within creation. And so all the commandments and all matters which are considered to be transgressions or sin in the more popular term contain these elements. So there's something that we sense or empower to sense, you know, our sensory systems, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, sense of touch. And then how do we react to that, those matters which come in contact with our five senses? And for instance, with regards to, like, say, nutrition and the element of the soul, which involves our imagination, there's no concept of observance or rebellion, because a person's thought, okay, and will do not affect them at all. A person cannot necessarily stop or limit these activities because we're constantly thinking, okay, and we're constantly observing phenomena in the creation, as reflected by the fact that these two elements that are involved in, say, how we digest things and how we imagine things are even active during our sleep. So, you know, here we are, Dennis and Cartrell. I hope Cartrell's still with us. That we're coming into contact with knowledge of oneself. How are we hardwired? Dennis, let me ask you, when you came into the teachings of Rambam or other theological teachings in your youth or as you matured as an adult through the time you are alive today, how the process of being empowered by self-knowledge of how you're, does that stimulate you? Does that make you feel more alive? Does it help you want to share these concepts with other people?
Well, all humans have a need for knowledge. It's just the question of whether do they recognize it? Are they willing to go with it or not? And that's inherent in most humans. We are curious type of people. We are people who are interested. And very few people can say, I don't want to deal with other humans. I want to live on an island and be all by myself. Philosophers have thought about this for a long time, but we need other people. We need other people because we don't know everything. And there is an inherent need way down deep. If you want to say it's in the soul, fine. But psychologists and psychiatrists have been trying to figure this out for a long time. They may never find out, but it is there. And I found out that as you keep learning and understanding more, you feel like you're empowered because you're closer to something. You're not too sure what it is, but you know it's a positive concept. It is God-driven.
Right.
It is God-driven, and we must recognize that. So therefore, knowledge is not a bad thing. Education is not a bad thing. Ignorance is not beautiful. It is only beautiful if you have the wrong things that you're emphasizing in your heart and mind.
Beautiful. Before I go to Cartrell, if you're still there, we have a caller. Is that you, Peretz Levine?
Yeah, can you hear me this time? I don't know if my phone's working anymore.
Okay, I hope you didn't get it wet this time. We don't need any clicking.
Right.
Hey, Peretz, first of all, shalom aleichem, good morning. We have Dennis Ryan on the phone, who is our advocate. Hopefully he'll share with us a little guide that's perplexed in a moment. And we also have Cartrell Gore, who is the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, an organization committed to empowering individuals in the five boroughs of New York, as well as a truant officer. And we have our local Levite musician, Peretz. Peretz, rather than try to rehash for you the last 35 minutes, I'll ask you to jump in and comment based on, Dennis, if you have the Book of Guides of the Perplexed in front of you, if you'd like to share a little wisdom of Maimonides. We just shared a little bit wisdom of him already.
Well, I'd like to mention one thing that was already mentioned in the program, and that is the so-called concept of idolatry as it relates to Christians, where they believe, some people believe that Christians worship three gods. Well, in effect, that is not true. Even the Rambam has specifically stated that there's the Catholic belief of three in one is doesn't enter into any variation because it results in only one God. And that is the key to belief, not in multiple gods, but one God. So the Rambam has already said that from a philosophical and theological viewpoint, the combination of three in one is immaterial because there is only one God. Now, we do have, in the Guide to Perplexed, we have in chapter 27, we have the general object of the law is twofold, the well-being of the soul and the well-being of the body. The well-being of the soul is promoted by correct opinions communicated to people according to their capacity. Some of these opinions are therefore imparted in plain form, others allegorically. Because certain opinions are in their plain form too strong for the capacity of common people, the well-being of the body is established by a proper management of the relations in which we live one to another. This we can attain in two ways. First, by removing all violence from our midst. That is to say, that we do not do everyone as he pleases, desires, and is able to do. But every one of us does that which contributes towards the common welfare. Secondly, by teaching every one of us such as good morals as to produce a good social state. Of these two objects, the one, the well-being of the soul, or the communication of correct opinions, comes undoubtedly first in rank.
Beautiful.
Parrots, would you like to comment on what Dennis just read from The Guide to the Perplexed?
Well, I can just kind of give parallel readings that I have also based on Jewish halacha, Jewish law, basically, and it was something in the Western philosophical world with Immanuel Kant where he made the distinction between a priori reasoning and practical reasoning. There are certain types of forms of logic and rationale. When a person waxes in his mind, he can understand the syllogisms logically, rationally, that the person has a certain axiom, and there's a certain, it's predicated by a certain condition, this will be the result. That could be true in logic. Sometimes it's not true actually, because there are certainly exceptions where a person in the world would say if all snow is melted by fire, and a person places fire next to snow, the snow will be melted. In the upper world, this snow and fire can coexist. I mean, so too in the person's mind, they can coexist in a certain way. When we speak of the practical reasoning that Jewish law is geared to, it also involves maybe, let's say, a majority opinion where they're going to go according to two rabbis' opinions about a certain practical law, certain practical comportment behavior. For instance, a person doesn't eat broken meat, but if a person drops a certain amount of milk into a pot full of meat, a meat stew, he certainly would be nullified in 60 parts. That's the practical halacha. However, there are persons that hold that a person doesn't have to wait more than an hour between meat and milk. There are those that hold by 3 and those hold by 6. So they're speaking about practically different conclusions. The eating of milk and meat. Now we know in certain worlds where it says specifically in the biblical passages, I think in Parshas Vayera, in the book of Genesis, that Abraham served his angel guests. He served them first, I think, curd, then he served them lamb or some type of meat. And we don't see any hours says the times between the times you see the time factor in between those dishes. We do know that, however, that was before Torah was given at Sinai when these laws were provided to mankind, to Jewish people, and to mankind, to govern their lives in a practical way. Immanuel Kant also says that there's a form of a priori reasoning, a reasoning which is something that is, before experience is given to us, we can have, there are certain elements in the mind that are God-given logical faculties. Rambam often speaks about, when he speaks about the Torah being also an allegorical book, in addition to being representing simple meanings. He speaks about fire. He says fire can represent, according to the prophetic use of the word fire, ash. It can represent God's wrath or anger, or simply to represent a tearing up element, an element that burns, consumes, makes into charcoal. You know, there are definitely ways of reading different facticity in the world. When it comes to rearranging facticity that's already existed in the world, for instance, the revision of history and the revision of like simple plain facts on the ground. Like Bob Dylan once used it very interestingly in a film called Don't Look Back. They wanted to know, what do you mean by your lyrics, all these wonderful lyrics? And he said, sometimes I have a plain picture, let's say, of a vagabond vomiting by a green door. You know, it's a very plain, austere picture of depravity, of decadence, you know. That brings out a very, very, you know, sort of feeling tone in the person. He reacts to it accordingly. The Torah often speaks in a simple sense, in a clear-cut language, in a logical, clear-cut language, which gets to the point in the shortest way possible. It's called Loshon Nekiya, I think, in the sect of Pesachim, the tractate called Pesachim. And its tendency is to even omit vowels or letters, if it can, to get to the meaning in the shortest route possible. And that's the way people ought to govern their speech. I mean, I they should speak basically as simply as possible. It's hard in a society where, there's a lot of prolixity, and people are verbose, you know. There's a lot of, you know, fancy adjectival terms that people use when they're speaking. They want to add, flower up the language, things like that, you know. But about speech in general, I missed the first 30 minutes, so certainly I don't really know what was going on fully. But I heard some of the things in the last five. I thought the show started, by the way, at 10:30 today. I must have been mistaken. I didn't realize.
I told 10 o'clock. Okay, thank you, Chris. Gentlemen, I'd like to mention, before we get, again, we're going to start to cover some positive commandments concerning the speaking correctly according to Torah standards, that, you know, there are certain people walking around, I've been hearing it a lot, you see it on the internet, telephone conversations, that people are expecting an apocryphal event that's going to lead to the revelation of who we understand as Messiah, the Mashiach of Israel, and really the anointed one of all the nations, to lead us into this hopefully, soon in our days, this universal redemption in a peaceful, pleasant manner. People are looking forward to, like, something which is known as an apocalyptic ending, or apocrypha. Now, gentlemen, I'd like everyone to comment on this idea that we're already observing this, because anyone who's following you on a superficial level realizing there's, so to speak, an apocryphal event taking place in Japan right now. I mean, I just heard on the news this morning that 18 miles off the coastline of Japan, that the high levels of radioactivity are already in the water, women and pregnant women and children in the vicinity of where the nuclear power plant has had a disaster are being advised not to drink the water. The adults are being, other adults, not in the category of pregnant women or young children, are being told okay to drink the water. Personally, I would run away from such water. Someone told me in my congregation this morning that a plane flying over Japan, over Chicago, Illinois, already now has had increased radiation levels detected on the physical outside of the plane. So for those people who are looking forward to a slashing and jashing and bloodthirsty antecedent toward the time of redemption, I want to cool off their enthusiasm. I'd like you gentlemen to comment on this. There's a great teacher, actually a grandson, a physical grandson, Rabbi Yisro Bar Shem Tov, who is the modern patriarch of the Hasidic movement. And Rabbi Nachman taught the following. You don't need a gunshot to bring the Mashiach, to bring the Messiah. So, gentlemen, I'd like you to chime in. And also, let's remember, too, we've got a bloodbath over there in Libya right now. And I'm not going to go into which side I'm taking. I mean, it's just because it's such a difficult situation over there in Libya. Because it's not like Republicans and Democrats. And it's even more complicated than, say, the clashes in Shia and Sunni. We're talking about actual tribal peoples under one band, under a symbolic name called Libya, as opposed to, say, like what you have in Iran or Iraq or even in Israel or in America, Republicans, Libertarians. Dennis, what's your take on all this, and why people should already be opening their eyes that we don't really want an apocalypse now, and it's not necessary to bring the Mashiach in that way. Your comments, questions, or concerns about that?
Well, I'm sorry for those people who believe or interpret that the end of the world, because it's been interpreted that way for many times in the history of mankind. We have many people who predicted the end of the world. Let me tell you, as far as I believe, if and when the world is going to come to an end, the Lord is going to make a statement, and everybody's going to know by his power and thunder that we have reached a real apocalypse. But until that time happens, these are man-made type of situations, and because people are not on the right and correct path, they're going to keep on pushing problems on other humans. And because we have this proclivity to cause these problems, be it the false interpretation or the false use of science, etc., we are causing our own problems. So therefore, you shouldn't confuse human problems with God's resolution of mankind.
Yes, then. Thank you. Cartro, are you still on the line? Cartro, are you still on the line? Okay, Peretz, I'd like you to balance, you know, before you chime in, Peretz, I'd like to remind everyone that the Rambam writes that the laws of prophecy that the Rambam writes about in his Mishnah Torah, that he writes is that where we see negative prophecies as listed in the Old Testament or in the Tanakh, the teachings of the prophets or in the writings of Psalms or Ecclesiastes or Lamentations, are only there to help us understand that there is a merciful Father, there is a merciful Creator, and that we see from, for instance, the idea of the city of Nineveh, the prophet Jonah, the Navi Yonah, was sent to ask them to repent, and what was destroyed was their wickedness, not the physical city itself. And actually, the Most High rebuked the prophet Jonah, certainly an elevated conscious individual, that he's asking, why would you want me to destroy, you know, 100,000 people and their animals who don't know the difference between the right or left or right and wrong? So, Peretz, why are people forgetting the teaching of Rabbi Nachman? You don't need a gunshot to bring redemption, as opposed to looking forward to some sort of John Wayne or Rambo version of Messiah.
Yeah, I think that people in particular, I mean, I myself, I know from my own observations of my personal life and comparing it to the, you know, the world around me and current events in history, sometimes people need a sensationalist awakening, the arousal from something that really, really is, you know, sometimes it can be cataclysmal, sometimes it can be wonderfully elating, you know, whatever it is. They don't seem to see the, read the subtle hints that are given, provided on a daily basis in a diurnal sense. We see signs in our lives, miraculous things happening, sometimes synchronicity when events coincide, and we can't explain how it is when I was thinking of that person, I met him in the street, or how it was that I was there. My friend told me he was in place 25 years ago when he became a repentant Jew, and that day his daughter happened to take a wrong route, and then that same day he saw the very house that he used to live in when he had just about given up his Judaism. He wanted to throw his kippah, his yarmulke away, because he couldn't live this lifestyle. When he saw that his door had been wet that night, and the same house that he was going to throw his Judaism away 27 years ago, he realized that's why we came to this spot. It was a synchronicity. It was a sort of subtle, for those who were tuned in, not so subtle, but a very obvious miracle. I'm referring also to, what's happening in Japan, what's happening in Libya, what's happening in Israel, what's happening in Iran. I mean, one can make his political assessments of them. He can interpret history the way he wants. But what I can clearly see now is that Japan has always been a country which was very competent in its use of technology. It's the third largest world power producer, in terms of electronics and technological innovations. Including America, and I think in Israel actually is another one. But it turns out that Japan was always overconfident in employing its technology, and yet when three Bahram went to the airport there, who were evidently, they stashed some type of narcotics in their suitcases about a year ago, a year and a half, 2 years ago now, Japanese law holds that a person, they might have been innocent or not witting of what was in their suitcases, and it was stashed, and they were stooges for some type of narcotics person, but they were held culpable in terms they should have known. They should have known better not to allow that to happen to them. And according to that Japanese law, they're held culpable and have to be incarcerated accordingly. Well, the Japanese should have known that if you're going to build all these power plants, put them by a riverbank, and there's going to be a tsunami, that's going to devastate that power plant, maybe cause a nuclear meltdown, maybe even a fission, God forbid, right? They should have known better, you know? Well, they hold people culpable for having, they should have known better. And, according to the incarceration of these three innocent Bakurim, I think somehow there's a divine retribution it sounds crazy and sounds reactionary, but I think because they hold people culpable for what they should have known, and incarcerated according to their being, you know, according to what they should have known, incarcerated for their misappropriation of nuclear power, which is not simply for technology advancements and for, you know, making energy conservation. I think they're employing it for belligerent purposes. I really believe that Japan, in World War II, twice employed, they employed a sneak attack on Americans whilst they were negotiating peace with Americans. It took two atomic bombs to stop their kamikaze pilots, you know, to awaken in them some type of, to edify them that this can't go on. You can't just, cement to their deaths and hope to win a war. This is something that we learned from history. And basically, we gave Japan many, many years the right to produce tremendously, fruitful technological, electronic goods and culture of advancements, nuclear speaking, in a nuclear sense, in a conservation of energy sense. I only know that my anathema toward Japan is basically based on history, that there have been a very bellicose people in Manchuria. They slaughtered the women after they raped them like pigs. They would slaughter them like, if they raped them like women, they would slaughter them like pigs. That's some of the language they used when they were. So they've been
slow down a little bit. Slow down your speech a little bit.
Right, they've been a very militant culture, a very bellicose culture. Now I think Mita connected Mita, measure for measure.
Slow down.
Yeah. I think everything is measure for measure in this world. Everything is Mita connected Mita. And I do see some type of divine justice in what's happening. Unfortunately, it's happening to the innocent people who are at the behest of people who are power-hungry and bellicose and belligerent, and they're misappropriating nuclear power, basically. That's what they're doing. And I think God is showing them in a very, very blatant way this is a wrong way to to utilize power that even Valor, the Hungarian physicist, really reneged of ever introducing to FDR.
Dennis, would you like to chime in? I want to respond to what you said first. Dennis, would you like to chime in?
Well, it's very easy to slip into the conspiracy theories that there's something behind all the stuff that's going on. To me, the only real conspiracy is the devil. So he will make humans feel uncomfortable, make sure they do wrong things, and try them to see if they still can hang on to what they believe in and what their faith is. I feel sorry for those people who don't have faith, because what are they to do? Yes, they think that the end of the world is coming and we're misusing all this stuff. But all human problems are repeats of history in some way, shape, form, or fashion. These things have happened before, and we've handled them, we've lived through them, and our faith is strong as it's always been. So therefore, we cannot all of a sudden say, this is a new thing that's happening. No, it's a variation of something that's old. Humans are always in these predicaments, and it's a question of who is strong enough to come through so that we can continue on.
Right. I just want to comment. First, if I understood you correctly, you're making some sort of connection or correlation between the travesty committed against those three rabbinical students and to the nuclear power accident. I just want to point out to you that, again, these types of statements were not even made by someone as elevated, say, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And when he addressed natural disasters in some part of creation, I think he was hesitant, if I recall, from the little that I know from his teachings, to connect the dots in such a way. We really need a real prophet to sort of connect those dots. And I want to point out that I recently learned this, that actually Japan has been supportive of Judaic activity in the land, just as even China, which has been oppressive of, say, like the Buddhists or the Tibetan monks in Tibet under the leadership of, the Dalai Lama, that they, although they've been oppressive of him and his followers, they've actually been they've actually assisted the Jewish people in China. In fact, I just learned recently that Matthias Yao, young Jewish Hasidic singer here in Crown Heights, actually had one of the opening ceremony songs. So the thing is that I think that you know, we sometimes want to connect point A to B, but actually I think that I would suggest that the Japanese people, just as the American government, share a certain culpability with, say, for instance, the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, if everyone remembers that, about five and a half years ago, that actually my father, who was a professional engineer with 50 years plus experience, was explaining to me that actually the levees in Louisiana were not built to the capacity they could have been, and this is, and actually the
Army Corps of Engineers was actually taken to court and sued and lost, I think, on the federal level for their irresponsibility in not building levees which were of the standards of, say, like in Italy and other European countries which have less resources than the American government to build proper levees. So the Japanese government, I think their culpability with the nuclear accident, this tragedy they have right now, is the fact that they did not employ safety standards, or they should have had the foresight. I mean, there's a whole question, even if we, you know, which is, we're not going to go into it now, but personally, from my father's experience and even some of the scientists he led me to interact with, whether or not nuclear power is a viable energy source, not just from the energy efficiency, but the fact, how do you deal with accidents? For instance, right now, the governor, Christie of New Jersey, has authorized a study to meet with the people. There's four nuclear plants in Jersey, with, you know, 35 miles from New York City, with the Indian Point power plant. So the question is, whose responsibility is? There's private industry, and then there's the government, who's supposed to be the arm or the protective shield for the people. Now let's go back in history. Now, when that the event which is recorded in Torah as the antecedent to the destruction of the five cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, where a young woman who was actually one of the, I think, daughters of Lot, the niece of Abraham, she extended a kindness to a stranger, and she was caught for doing so, and kindness is actually forbidden in the land, in the five municipalities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and she was literally stripped naked, and she had honey poured on him, and she died a very heinous type of death, and her cries above led to the elicitation of the Asian Godfrey's, the fire and brimstone. And with all that, Abraham, our patriarch Abraham, prayed for mercy for them. Also, we see when Dinah, who is the daughter of Yaakov, was raped by Shechem, Hamor ben Shechem. His name was Hamor ben Shechem. Ron Williams once pointed out to me, it's brought down the orchard, that actually he publicly humiliated her sexually in front of a crowd of people. So with those three students, rabbinical students, said, was there an agenda that was it a nationwide agenda to publicly humiliate them, to publicly judge? I don't know. I mean, I don't follow Japanese news on a daily basis. So I just want to chime in on that. So I'd like to move on to the next subject, which is really supposed to be the meat of a program, but we've taken 59 minutes to talk about things which are very current in the creation right now. And now we're going into the positive commandments of how to speak properly. So the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kogan HaKohen, wrote this seminal book over 100 years, I think, way over 100 years ago. So he brings down a positive commandment to help us remember how to speak properly, is, as it's brought down in Deuteronomy 24, verse 9, remember what the Lord your God did unto Miriam by the way you came forth of Egypt. So actually, this is something which is one of the a matter that we should recall every day in the Jewish liturgy, which we mention every morning after concluding our morning prayers, where the Torah is obligating us, the Chafetz Chaim brings down, to vocally recall the punishment Miriam received for speaking evil talk about her brother Moshe Rabbeinu. But however, there were the Chafetz Chaim mentions five mitigating factors which softens her transgression and thus her punishment. Number one, when she spoke about her brother, she loved him dearly. Number two, Miriam actually risked her life to save Moshe, who was the first redeemer of Israel, when he was an infant. Number three, she raised him as a child. Number four, she did not speak anything derogatory about Moses, but she really minimized the extent of his greatness. Number five, she didn't speak in his presence. She didn't suffer embarrassment. Number six, she didn't speak about him in public. She had a private conversation with Aaron, her brother. And also seven, that Moshe, who was the paragon of humility, was not affected by what Miriam said about him. Actually, I think seven matters that the Chafetz Chaim said which mitigated her judgment, yet still we are recalled. We are asked to remember a woman as righteous as Miriam, who was involved in saving many young Hebrew Israelite lives at that time when Pharaoh had decreed that all boys should be thrown into the Nile River, yet she was still held accountable. So Dennis and then Peretz, what lesson can we share to make a universal message to other people to recall how even a righteous person as Miriam was still held under, she didn't have a privilege, she didn't earn points because of her righteousness, but she was also held accountable. Therefore, we should try to understand we're also to be held accountable for what comes out of our mouth.
Nobody is perfect, and we all make mistakes. However, there's some things that come out of our mouth that we cannot take back. Once it comes out of your mouth, there is no reversal procedure involved. It came out, people hear it. It's almost like if there's a trial and a witness says this, that, and the other thing, and someone says, one of the attorneys tells the judge, instruct the jury that that wasn't unimportant and they shouldn't consider it. Well, that's nice to say, but once you hear it, it's in your brain. You don't have a giant eraser that was given to us to take things out of our brain. So therefore, you must be responsible for what you say because other people are going to hear it. And who knows what effect that's going to have. So therefore, you must take responsibility. Ignorance is not an excuse. We must own up to our responsibility regardless of our motives. If you were well-intentioned, but you said some bad things, well, you're still responsible. However, you kept using the word mitigated, Don. Got to be careful with that word because normally there's only one being that judges people. So therefore, we have to be careful with what is mitigating because now we're starting to split hairs. You must be responsible for what you speak. So therefore, you must absorb the punishment that goes along with that.
Right. But I just want to point out that in Torah, within the perspective of Torah, there are things that can soften judgment. I mean, King Solomon writes he writes very clearly in Proverbs, charity spares one from death. And actually, in chapter 41, verse 1 or 2, if you bear with me as I pull it out, because I don't remember exactly, that, bear with me, please, that King David writes that is fortunate. It's chapter 4 and verse 2. That is, fortunate is the person who is thoughtful of the poor, for the Lord will save him on the day of evil. Didn't say fortunate is the righteous person, or totally righteous, but actually fortunate is one who is thoughtful for the poor, because in the merit that a person was thoughtful, and it's learned out from the oral Torah traditions, if you want to split heads, that a person who helps a poor person, whether it be financially poor, and a poor person is also called, a sick person is also called a poor person. Fortune is one who helps a person restore their health and to restore their spiritual health by coming close to the Most High, that that person will be spared. So we do see, actually, from Scripture itself, in the event of charity saves one from death, and also be considerate of the poor, whether they be in financial matters or in spiritual matters, that actually that is a circumstance that can save them from a certain judgment on a day of evil, which is interpreted from the Zohar, which is in the Kabbalistic teachings, when the element of judgment is dwelling within the world. Felix, what is your comments, questions, and concerns about this matter?
The Torah has a clear-cut way of making distinction and sequestering what it considers kosher, not kosher, pure, impure, invalid, valid, good, evil, things like that, you know. I as a student of the Torah and a person who does make distinctions, not just empirically what I see in the world, but what I see historically, and employing my critical eye according to the, according to my meager knowledge and of the Torah and its, how it infuses my intellect and my judgment, I have to say that I've seen motions historically that testify that certain people are certainly not blessed. I have to wax again onto the historical issue of the Edomites and the Amalekites and other peoples whose whole whose whole purport has been to destroy peoples whose whose lifestyle or whose very existence posed a threat to them. The Jews posed a threat to the Amalekites on the way out of Egypt. The Amalekites got the stragglers. The Egyptians enslaved the Hebrew people because the Hebrew people were multiplying and that threatened their civilization. The Germans in modern times became enemies of the Jewish people because they were a threat to their finance, so-called threat to their finance. The Japanese were allies with the Germans. Maybe were ignorant of Jews because they didn't have Jews there in Japan. But now, I mean, after these incarcerations of these poor rabbinical students who were supposed to be accountable for something they didn't know, now the Japanese people are being accountable for something they didn't know they should have known, you know? I think that everything is so blatantly visible. We have to have compassion on that all these innocent, you know, sub-villagers, these people that have nothing to do with the higher echelon in Japanese society who are comporting these 53 power plants to be built and to be used for possibly bellicose reasons. I can't believe it's all for technological events, but I do believe the Japanese people historically have been a bellicose people, a people of the sword, a people whose proof of their dominion came through a military, you know, through might and through, you know. But we see clearly that the Japanese certainly had given domicile to Jewish students at one time during World War II, which is an ironic twist. And I find it, nobody has the right to judge a whole people, certainly. The calamity that's happening now, nobody knows what's really the real reasons for it, and the esoteric reasons except for God Almighty himself. But we have to look at the patterns of history. We have to apply the critical eye of Torah on them and call evil evil, call good good, and don't mince the words. We cannot be, so to speak, everything doesn't go into a void that we say. Nothing is really mitigated. Everything is remembered. We can forgive, and we can be magnanimous with peoples up to a certain point. Then we have to fight back, and we have to tell people, no, we cannot accept Palestinian people living in the land of Israel. They're going to blow us up. We cannot accept this as a fact on the ground. The Jewish people have to be very strong and not to mollify, not to be milksops to the opinions of the other nations who really don't feel sometimes any compassion or any, really, you know, for the actual the precepts of the Torah, nor the feeling tone that the stories in the Torah generate in their heart that should really, really edify them, that they should comport themselves according to the tzaddik and according to the righteous forefathers and the righteous Jewish people who are a light to the other nations. We have to heed the word of Jewish people in the biblical sense and the rabbinical sense, because there's no real separation between the rabbinical commentaries and the Talmud and the actual written Torah. They were given simultaneously at Sinai.
Let me interject. When you go ahead and call the Japanese people bellicose, you can't look any further than your own backyard of the history of the European coming to North America. If you talk to an American Indian from basically the 16th century, so early 17th century onward, or you want to go back to Columbus, 48 million North Central and South American Native American Indians or Mexicans would have been wiped out. I mean, certainly the North American European peoples have been some of the most bellicose in history.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's why I think it's a very and also the fact that, you know, with the how many people at the time of 9/11 that they're saying that the reason was this because of homosexuality. I mean, I kind of think this is an argument of the blind trying to lead the blind. And as far as the Palestinian people, let me be very clear again. It is not a dovish, leftist, peace now approach to say the Palestinian people can live in Israel if they keep the seven Noahide commandments. According to Torah, again, I'll refer everyone to go back to the oral and written traditions of what happened when Joshua, Yeshua, Ben Nun had led Israel in. It is clearly written in rabbinical teachings. He offered them peace on the condition to the Canaanite nations, I should say, were not the Palestinian people or even the Philistine people, that they must realize that we have been bequeathed this land. This is not splitting heads. It's open prophecy that fell with Abraham and then to Isaac and Yaakov and culminating with the children of Israel going out of Egypt, that they can live in the land if they will subdue their inclination to the seven Noahide commandments to work with us. And not only that, according to the seven Noahide commandments, the Israelites are commanded to help sustain, not just spiritually, but physically, the people in the land. Now, the fact that there's a bellicose attitude on the what's going on, it's horrible what's going on in Gaza right now, they have to be responded. There have to be a strong response. It's not, you know, no one's looking to put flowers into the missile projectile machinery in the Gaza Strip as if to say that's what's going to end the conflict. In fact, most people aren't aware of the fact that despite the fact there is a conflict, at least 1 to 2 times a week, that the state of Israel, being paid by Jewish people, is in fact paying for medicine, food, and I don't know clothing, but I know medicine and food and other materials are brought into the Gaza Strip. In fact, one Jewish driver was actually murdered last year, it was, in his attempt to make a delivery. So we are, even before they keep the 7 Noahide commandments in the full sense, because they have to fulfill not to commit premeditated murder, which they are doing every time they an attempt to shoot, to launch a rifle, a missile, excuse me. So, you know, we are trying to hold up our end, they are not. And unfortunately, it's the sense of, I guess, trepidation on the Israeli government to respond in a way that they should respond out of fear of America. But we have nothing to fear of America, because America itself is now in engaged in so many activities, while on the governmental level, you know, on a state-by-state level, people are facing, you know, the fight for their lives to retain the most basic services, which should be, I would suggest humbly, their neighbor rights to be sustained as human beings on this earth. So I just want to chime in. I'm not taking a dove position, Pepez, but I just want to say, I just have to respond, because this is a public forum. When we start pointing at who is bellicose, really the history of all nations are bellicose. The history of all nations are warlike. The history of all nations are, and this includes Israel, because it says in the prophet, Israel is, it can be destroyed for lack of knowledge. The lack of knowledge of the Torah traditions puts us into a situation where the blind are leading the blind. So I don't know where we're going to go, but just keep on calling the Japanese people bellicose, because if we look to the North American state, the 235 years of this country, you know, we're second to none in terms of being bellicose, whether it be in an expansionist manner, or in a defensive manner, and then sometimes in the name of defense, being defensive, being very offensive. And all of these countries, every country around the world, without the knowledge of the Noahide commandments, are going to be transgressing these very commandments of nation not making war against nation. I mean, it is clear. So I'm saying, you know, let's take a, this is not an idealistic look, this is the Torah itself, from my own humble opinion, saying that, you know, everyone is screwing up the Creator's plan right now.
I mean, the Torah speaks clearly of the other nations. I speak to, I'm not just referring to Japanese, I'm referring to the Puritans who massacred Indian reservations, Indian villages, and then remove them completely to the last man and woman in the most cruel and unusual way. I'm referring to the English imperialism in Ireland. I'm referring to the imperialism. I'm referring to almost every nation in the face of the earth. If they do not employ their judgment properly, and they see others as an antagonist and as something that's an anathema to their point of view or their lifestyle, they'll attack at human nature. But I'm only saying on a historical basis that there are certain nations who have proven themselves over and over again to be people who misappropriate their technology and their intellect in such a way where they abuse other peoples to the point of complete cruelty and unusual cruelty, like the Germans, like the Japanese, like the, I have to say, like practically every nation in the world. And that means basically, I mean, if we're going to include the Jewish people among them, who are compared to sheep among the wolves, we have to say that they may be misappropriating their power by allowing people who are attacking them continuously over and over again for many, many years, to allow them to actually feed the enemy, to give them rifles and to give them medicine, get them out of there, and get them out of the place where they can destroy and shoot missiles into civilian territory on a daily basis, even for the last 10 years. That's all.
Okay. Fine.
Yeah.
But let's remember too, and I like Dan to chime in. Let's remember, the Hitler war machine was fueled by American businessmen. So you know what I mean. So what do you do then when IBM and Ford and General Motors, you know, steamrolled the way for the Nazi regime to be empowered to cause, which eventually led to the destruction of 15 million human beings, and that doesn't even include what Stalin was doing over in Russia. Dennis, what's your take on all this?
This goes back to speech again, Don. We must be very careful how we categorize what things and label them, because he can inadvertently be passing judgment on these people, because do they deserve it? It's not our judgment to decide that. Now, I can understand someone saying, well, these people have a history of this. Yes? So what? Is that bad or good? I mean, I'm not saying they did bad or good things, But what I'm saying is there are some people who just don't get it. They're not educated. They don't understand. We must absorb it because in the eyes of God, we must fit everything together into the natural order of things. We cannot get away from that concept. We cannot treat exceptions as excuses. We cannot treat variations as though that's never happened before. Baloney. There's nothing that you can say or do that some human being on the face of the earth hasn't already done in some way, shape, or fashion. So let's not pretend that all of a sudden this is a point of discovery. No, it's a lack of understanding. And that's what we're about, and that's what this program is about. You must be responsible for your speech, and you must concentrate and learn something about God.
Yes. So let's go on to our next commandment, which is very interesting. I don't know if people are thinking in these terms. And this is the Chofetz Chaim Sofer, the second positive commandment, which is connected. In Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, it says to love your neighbor as yourself. So the Chofetz Chaim brings down, he brings down Rambam in the laws of human conduct, known as Hilchot Deot, chapter 5, law 3. The Torah obligates us to be equally considerate of the property and dignity of others as we are of our own. So when we speak or we listen to Lashon Hara, which is evil speech, a person is meant to show that he does not love the subject and definitely not to the degree that one loves oneself. And of course, you know, a person can be aware of his or her own faults. He doesn't want anyone to speak about them. If someone does relate his faults, he hopes that the listeners will reject what they hear. So anyone who speaks or accepts the Lashon Hara violates this commandment. Now, gentlemen, you know, I don't know if how many people connect those type of dots. I mean, you know, we have to stay conscious. The whole idea, if you really truly love your neighbor, you shouldn't be speaking negative about him. Dennis, your take on this.
Can we really love our neighbors? Some people have a hard time with that. It's hard to overlook the things that bother you or bug you about other people. Some people just can't accept it. So we have a problem where a good portion of the world is obviously not practicing love thy neighbor. They may love God, but they have a hard time loving the neighbor. But regardless, we must persist. We must bring it to their attention, and we must keep repeating. Hopefully, something will sink in over a period of time. That doesn't mean we forgive them or bless them. Horse feathers. If they're doing wrong, it's wrong. But it all starts very simply with the misuse of speech, because it gives the wrong impression.
Right. Kurt, your take on connecting the dots between properly?
I love the magnanimity with which Dennis speaks about, you know, the speech faculty about just human nature. He's very magnanimous and he's very intelligent and perspicuous. I do think, though, that speech, because it is the way where we comport our world of thoughts into action, it's the intermediary between thought and you know, deed, we ought to also remember that there's a level of judgment that takes place in that realm, the realm where we deliver from the potential of building a building, let's say, to making a blueprint, from blueprint to expediting it with our hands. And that takes place also when a person lectures a potential architect with his speech. Now, as architects of peace, ultimately, we want, you know, we can, let's say, we can be zealous about something enough, we're so much committed to the feeling about it or the belief in it, we can't really, as you say, mitigate our zeal about a certain type of person. We either avoid the person because it's simply, history has taught us that this person has been very much anathema to me. Same thing with a certain nation. We have certain sanctions that are now on a nation like Iran, on Libya, and in fact in Libya we're even going in there, Americans are going in there and bombing them. But I think that takes place on the level of statesmanship. A person who's a politician uses a speech or a king to govern a people. I don't actually know where Obama stands on much of anything because he minces his words quite a bit. I don't mince my words. I think clearly, and I'll say it again and again as a Jewish zealot that I have become, seeing the history of our people in the last 100 years, I believe that we must not mince the word and call a lamb a wolf or a lamb, a snake, something that's kosher, or a snake that's, not going to bite you when you come within a foot of it. You know, we have to be very, very careful. The Torah clearly gives allegories of certain nations, compares them to snakes, to wolves, to predatory animals. He compares the Jewish people to sheep. Ultimately, no matter how zealous I sound or how critical or cruel it might sound, I do believe history has edified me enough to say that we must not give any of these people potentially the Noahide distinction. And what we see now in front of us on a nationwide scale is an attempt for people that have no... I mean, first of all, the category we call Palestinian today is a false category. There were no such people as Palestinians. There were people that came from Iraq, or people that came from Jordan, or people that came from Egypt, or the surrounding Arabic countries. And they settled there because basically those countries kicked them out. And now they call them Palestinians. We call them, we label them, we Jewish people, we Israelis label them Palestinians. But this people turns out to be the Philistines. They're the Philistines. It's from the same etymological root. And they're people that are a thorn in our side, that Torah says will be a thorn in our side, as long as you feed them, as long as you give them electricity, as long as you basically allow them to perpetrate acts of war when you give it, Kalashnikov rifles like we did in the Oslo Accords in 1993 with the Shimon Peres administration, which was the most self-sabotaging act in the history of Israel that I've ever noted in modern times. This person, Shimon Peres, not only is he president again of Israel, but people have a short historical memory. He must be, somebody must take him out of office and out of political power altogether because he's done so much damage to his own people. I believe that Obama is doing terrible damage to the American people in as much as not stating what he means or means what he's stating.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
I ask you to slow down.
Yeah.
You think Mashiach is going to be someone who's going to say, you know, the Mashiach is here to educate not only the nation of Israel, Jewish people, but he's here to realign the consciousness of all, say who these Palestinian people, quote unquote. I say it, because of course we know there's no true Palestinian people because 2,000 years ago we had Jewish leaders. There were no quote unquote Palestinian leaders. We know that, but they are Noahides. That is not a spiritual level. That is a physical genealogy, and therefore still the Mashiach I still will find somewhere now. If they disagree with him, the Mashiach will have the power, the spiritual power, and any powers at his disposal to ask them to leave the country. Because again, we can't really go above the teachings of Yeshua ben Nun, a Novi, a prophet of Israel, who didn't, you know, unfortunately, that's the problem. People just read the written scriptures and say, well, we just killed all the Canaanim. In fact, we didn't. Because, and actually, it's written in the oral Torah that the Girgashite people left. So, again, as I mentioned before, the Palestinian people are truly Noahide people, and they should be dealt in that context according to Torah. If I just let my emotions run away with what I think should be done with them, am I truly going according to the spirit of Torah? And Lubavitcher Rebbe said, he played a teaching of them several weeks ago in the Frankel Shul in Crown Heights. He said that, yes, they should be shown force, but before a bullet is shown and missile is launched, they will, in fact, back down. So a strong Israeli presence, say in Gaza or in Ramallah, wherever you want to say, it will be. But again, the lacking is within our own people's consciousness of who we are, and that's why we have a show like this, talking about positive speech and bringing in the Kabbalah and the Kabbalah and the written scripture. And to show them that they actually have a responsibility towards making a better world. You know, I've heard too many people know how to say to me, well, it's upon you guys. You guys, no. The whole point of the Torah at Moses at Mount Sinai was to remind all the inhabitants of the world that we all have a part to play in making this better world. And every nation without any exception. Has not fulfilled on an actualized way, which Abba Marvel has a period of actualization. No one has touched, there are certain elated individuals in every nation. I mean, Dr. Michio Kaku is a he's one of the top disciples of Einstein, the co-author of the string theory. He is blowing a shofar of warning to not just the Japanese people, but to all the people in the world that this is horrible what's going on in Japan, and this is a harbinger, heaven forbid, of what could happen around the world. And again, before that trigger, the next time someone wants to pull the trigger is, what are we going to do? There is the matter of prayer. Jacob first prayed. Then Jacob prepared presents for Esau, his twin brother. And then he prepared for war. Unfortunately, whether it be in lamentation, whether it be the Jewish people, the American people, the Libyan people, the Syrian people, everyone forgot the lesson that would be a universal lesson to avoid conflict through prayer and gift of the Rebbe also, discussion. And then what is war? War is to minimize, future, is to reduce the damage. We don't want war. But unfortunately, peoples in the Middle East and North Africa are taking that plan because they forgot about the prayer. They forgot about the negotiations. And it's ego versus ego. And unfortunately, the Jewish ego is corrupted, unfortunately, to a certain extent within the government levels because they forgot about prayer. And the negotiation should be negotiations of acceptance of the Noahide commandments. And the war is not truly fought because they're afraid of what the world will say about us. So I don't think I'm taking a very dovey approach as opposed to, what we are expected from our mindset to so then when the heartfelt emotions come out, that it will be based on a mindset which has influenced those emotions. Not that we're just shooting from the hip our heart's reactions, because that's the one thing that our enemies want to throw against us, whether we be of the children of Israel or the children of Noah. Hey, look, they can be just like us, so why should we be like them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so listen, gentlemen, we got about 2 minutes to go, and I have a minute and 30 seconds dialogue. If anyone wants to throw in 30 seconds, Dennis, concluding comments for 30 seconds?
Yes, I have a 30-second. I believe all the problems in the world can be addressed, but I look at Jewish people as the people who have better understanding because they've been following the scripture and they believe in a lot of things that should be positive. So if we're having a hard time selling or having them understand some of these things, what do you think we're going to be doing with the people who haven't been studying, who haven't been concentrating on God? Is the world in a bad situation? Yes.
Yes, I so. That's 30 seconds.
Before the great light comes, is offered in darkness doubled and redoubled, and that's only a good sign for us that the ignorance of the world that's so spread, even among unfortunate Torah scholars themselves, we have to finally expedite true wisdom with the Messiah himself. I hope the Messianic era already comes, because we definitely need redemption, and it's from our own ignorance, and that includes the Torah scholars, and unfortunately I have to also back the claim of theirs that, it's a world benighted very greatly in thick darkness. Please, God, the light will come soon, and I hope, despite our, deficiencies, that everything will be filled in the peachy cream, that's my real hope, and I don't, everybody wants peace, but there's no exceptions, it's just people don't realize they want it, sometimes internally.
Okay. So that would bring to like the conclusion, thanking again Dennis Ryan, Gaucho Gord, and Eric Serena. We're going to end off with actually on a happy note, although I think it's been a very intense note today's show. It's called the Niggun Simcha. This was sung about, I think, 30 years ago in 770. And everyone have a blessed weekend. The biggest continues. The Habakkuk, one love.
Thank you very much.
Be well, Paris. I'm not going to be able to do that.